No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype in your questions at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS RADIOONE. Today's guest, Stephen Swoboda, unfortunately, will not be with us tonight because he fell ill. So we would like to offer Mr. Swoboda speedy recovery, and we hope that we can reschedule him soon. He sounded like a very interesting guest, and we hope we get him back on the show soon. But tonight, Maria and I are going to discuss politics, which is something we've been wanting to do lately because it's become so interesting, the presidential race. But we've had too many interesting guests, so we haven't been able to work it in, which is, you know, something that we a problem that we should always have, right?
It's true.
So without further ado, there's my lovely co-host, Maria. How are you, Maria?
Thank you, Michael. I'm doing really well, and thank you for your kind words about Stephen. He is a fascinating, compelling, riveting, and polarizing guest. And he has rescheduled, and I just need to clear it with you and our calendar, because when he sent me the message this morning, he was so like apologetic. I was like, no worries. We'll figure it out. So I appreciate that. And as you said, you and I spoke earlier this week, and it was like, when do we get to talk?
Right. And this is the vagaries of live radio, right?
That yes.
You have things happen. And if we taped the show, it would be different. But
I love about radio is that there is no second take. There is no safety net. It is live. What happens is what goes out of our mouths, and you don't get an opportunity to tweak it or edit it or rewind it or what have you, which makes it one of the sexiest and riveting aspects of broadcasting because of that immediacy,
yeah,
if you will.
I agree with you. I agree with you, and it's the nightmare of every politician, right?
Yes.
You know, how many times did you think Michael Dukakis said, "I wish I hadn't climbed into that tank," or
yes.
You know, somebody else had, you know, wish they had taken back something they said. And since we're going to start the show with politics, let me first say extend our condolences to the family of Nancy Reagan, to the Reagans. Nancy Reagan passed away today, as you probably know, in California. She was an amazing first lady, maybe the most active first lady, most influential first lady since Dolly Madison, and devoted to her husband, not a man that I always agreed with, but there was an amazing relationship, don't you think?
I do, and I agree with you on so many levels. I actually was sent the press release this morning from her spokesperson about her passing. The cause of death is congested congestive heart failure, and she will be buried next to her husband at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, and those details are forthcoming. Ironically, Michael, I was at the Reagan Library Friday morning because they have a new exhibit that opened yesterday called Vatican Splendors, and it's 2,000 years of art and history from the Vatican. Some of the pieces have never been seen because they were in private papal collections. So if anybody's listening who happens to be in Southern California or is making a trip here, it's definitely something that you would want to see. It's not only historical, but of course, religious. But they read a statement from Nancy Reagan on Friday morning. So I feel like I got to hear one of the last words that she uttered, because she was talking about how close her husband had felt to the various popes and to the Vatican over the years, and that it was her honor that this exhibit was going to be forthcoming. So it's kind of odd, almost, if you will, that that was Friday morning, and then she passed away this morning.
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, I'm sure it's a great exhibit, because being president is one thing, but being a pope is, that was an amazing thing to be, because most of the great artists in the Middle Ages were Catholics. And when the pope wanted something painted or carved or anything else, he just called one of them up and they responded. So I'm sure that it's amazing. It's amazing art. It's an amazing display. So
Even have a mock-up of what it was like for Michelangelo to be painting the Sistine Chapel, and they've got rafters built up, and to show you how he had to be that close and yet provide the depth of the vision from those folks that were down on the floor looking all that way up. I mean, one of the best things is at the very end, there's an interactive Saint John Paul II. They did a cast of his hand as well as the reverse, so you can put your hand in his hand.
Wow.
This was done while he was still alive. So that's the last thing of the exhibit, is that you can do that if you so choose, which of course I did.
Wow. And you know, Michelangelo really didn't want to paint the Sistine Chapel. He thought that that painting was beneath him. He was a sculptor, which he saw as a higher form of art. But when he refused to do it, the Pope just said, okay, well, anybody that does business with this guy will chop your head off. So he quickly ran out of options. Talk about power. You know, he quickly ran out of options and came back and said, you know what, Your Holiness, I can paint the ceiling. That's not a problem. So that's real power. Yeah. But Nancy Reagan also had some real power, even though she was the power behind the man. She was the first lady and maybe the only first lady to ever address the United Nations General Assembly. She addressed him. She addressed them over her "Just Say No" a drug effort, and she also pushed for something that I really admired her for. Is she pushed for stem cell research when her husband got Alzheimer's? And no matter how you feel, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, the Republican Party at the time was very much against it, and she stood up to him, showed great courage, I think, in standing up to them and saying, no, this is something we should do. So she was certainly her own person, and there's no doubt she was devoted to her husband.
Absolutely. And on that light that you were talking about with the substance abuse, she traveled 250,000 miles throughout the United States and the world to get her campaign out about fighting substance abuse. That's commitment.
Yes, it is. And you know, in a day when it wasn't too long before that, you know, first ladies were supposed to plant trees and flowers and, mm-hmm. Support the Girl Scouts and do, feminine things. They weren't supposed to get involved in substantive issues like drug abuse. Since then, of course, several first ladies have gotten involved in substantive issues. But prior to that, Not very many. And she was outspoken.
Yeah, it wasn't considered ladylike, if you will.
Right, it wasn't considered ladylike. And now, who knows, we might have a lady, our first lady president on the way.
Rolling them in and up, isn't she, with her 1,123 delegates?
Yeah. I mean, I've got to tell you something. I was surprised when I looked, Maria, to see that she was so far ahead of Bernie with 1,123, and he's at 481. I actually got a call from AP last week because I'm a superdelegate, and they asked if, who I was going to endorse, and I haven't made an endorsement. My opinion has always been, since the District of Columbia kind of lacks a voice in so many issues, that I'd wait and see what the voters of the district decide in the primary before I make any pronouncements. But she's racked up 458 superdelegates to his 22, and she's about halfway there. And so go ahead.
What does it mean to be a superdelegate? How did that happen, and how long has it been, and is it in perpetuity? And this is fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's totally different than what the Republicans do. But in 1985, I was actually at the Democratic committee when they came up with the idea of making superdelegates. And what superdelegates are is they're unpledged delegates. They're party leaders. They're considered elected officials and party leaders. So every United States senator, every member of Congress that's a member of the House that's a Democrat is a superdelegate. All governors are superdelegates. Party leaders, so that would include the chairman of the chair people of the 50 state parties, other people that are considered party leaders, and that changes from time to time. But certainly Bill Clinton would be a superdelegate, I believe, and other people that are leaders in the party.
So, Michael, how long have you been one?
I've been one ever since I've been elected. So this will be the third convention that I go to as a superdelegate. And what a superdelegate actually is an unpledged delegate. So what happens is when you run in a primary, when the primaries are run or the caucuses are convened, what happens is you elect delegates. You elect delegates to the convention, basically. It works very much the same way the Electoral College works, where you don't actually, the popular vote isn't what counts in the end. What counts in the end is the amount of electoral votes you get. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the convention, let's say Clinton won one primary where she got 50 delegates, those 50 people have to vote for Clinton. They have no other choice. And if she doesn't get the nomination on the first ballot, then they can change. But unpledged delegates, what we call PLEOs or superdelegates, they can vote for anybody they want right from the beginning. So
now, I understand that part, but does your commitment, let's say you made a commitment tonight, for example, can you change your mind tomorrow?
Yeah. You can change your mind up to the last minute. Yeah.
Really?
You can stand there in a Hillary t-shirt at the convention and vote for Bernie. You could change right to the very last minute. And you know what? It's never, ever, it was created in 85, it's never come into play except in the election of 2008. That was the first time it ever came into play, because it looked like Barack Obama and Clinton were going to be so close that the superdelegates might be the deciding factor. And I just want to tell you, I've got to tell this great story quickly, but it's what led to my 15 seconds of fame or 15 minutes of fame, because my brother is president of a college in Ohio, and he had no idea when I got elected shadow senator what exactly that meant. You know, what the hell's a shadow senator? He didn't know if I was an elected official or I was dealing drugs on the side and this was a cover. What was this office? So anyway, I get a call. Hillary Clinton is looking for delegates, and I get a call one night, and they say, can you have coffee tomorrow morning with Senator Clinton? And I'm like, yeah, okay. So I show up for coffee, and there's about 50 people at coffee, and they're all super delegates. So I sit down in the front of the room, and when Clinton comes in, she goes to the podium and then realizes that they're going to announce her. So she comes and sits next to me on this settee behind the podium. And at that time, she had just hired an old friend of mine named Maggie Williams to be her campaign manager just the day before. She had let her other campaign manager go, a woman named Celise, and hired Maggie, who had been her chief of staff at one time. So when she sat down next to me, I leaned over and I said, I introduced myself. I said, Senator Clinton, I'm Michael Brown. I'm the senator from D.C. And she kind of nodded. And I said, and I'm an old friend of Maggie Williams. And at that point, she turned around and went, oh, Maggie. And she gave me a big hug. And she said, yeah, I love Maggie. And I'm like, I love Maggie, blah, 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 blah. So my sister-in-law says she's watching TV that night with my brother, and on comes, you know, they say, and today Hillary Clinton was out schmoozing with the superdelegates, and there I am, my sister-in-law tells me, there I am rocking back and forth with Hillary Clinton on the couch like we dated in high school or something. Woo-hoo! You know, and we're all friends. And my brother goes, oh my God, that's Michael. And then as fate would have it, 2 days later, she wants to go to Ohio and give a speech. And my brother's college has just built this really nice new facility, but it's kind of small. His college was a small college. And of course, that's where they want to go, because they don't want to go to Ohio State, because they don't want to go into a venue where you have 17,000 people, right, and you can't fill it up, right? You know, right, you don't want a half empty auditorium. So they want this lovely new auditorium, which holds about 1,000 people, which they think they can fill, and they do. And they come to the college, and my sister-in-law again tells me that my brother goes out and says, hello, Senator, I'm Paul Brown, I'm president of the college. And then she says, he kind of looks around and sheepishly says, and my brother is the shadow senator from Washington. And Clinton says to him, oh, yeah, Mike, I just had coffee with him. My brother thought, you know, wow. So he started calling me and saying, how's Hillary? How's it going? You guys having lunch together? And I had to finally say, Paul, I went for Barack Obama, so she's not speaking to me anymore. But yeah, there was a superdelegate that got me my fame in my family with my brother. But, you know, AP called me this week, and they asked me about it. They're doing a story about superdelegates. And I said to the guy, don't the Republicans wish that they had superdelegates right now? Because with all this effort to stop Donald Trump, this would certainly be one way that they could do it. And that was the idea behind superdelegates, so that we wouldn't get a candidate that was too outside the box. And when we did it, we thought to ourselves, many of us thought, wow, this isn't particularly Democratic. But
well, that's
why it was done.
Our local papers have been filled with this Trump, you know, issue, and the opinions are coming from all over. They've been polling politicians from our area, and they've been polling regular John Q. citizens and everything else, and even the op-ed pieces. It's definitely gotten traction and everybody's attention. And what I'm thinking is it's going to hopefully get people to come to the polls that might not have, or the people who usually don't vote,
yeah,
because one way or another, you got to have an opinion.
That's right. And you know what? He's done that already and getting, you know, they're seeing lots of people in the Republican primaries that haven't come to the polls yet, haven't traditionally come to the polls, and they're not seeing the same thing on the Democratic side. But I looked at the numbers. I said I was surprised by Clinton, but I was also surprised that Trump's at 382 delegates and Cruz is already at 300.
Yep.
So he's really not that far behind.
He's not. Yeah, I saw that this afternoon, too. And then Rubio, of course, got all 23 from Puerto Rico. So that pushes him almost to 200. So it's very interesting. And I think, Michael, it's unprecedented, is it not?
Yeah, I think so, too.
When has a non-politician run for president?
Well, I don't know that that's so unprecedented, but
Well, I mean, you know, we had Michael Horowitz and we had Russ Perot and stuff like that, but we didn't have anybody who actually was a front runner.
Right. Well, that's And that's something that, you know, in itself should be a discussion, because I think when the framers set up the country, they really didn't expect there to be a professional political class. You know, I think they expected that people that ran for public office would very often be, you know, I don't know what you want to call them, regular people, people that had other occupations, farmers and lawyers and doctors and
day jobs.
And we created, it seems to me, in this country, a class of professional politicians. And I don't know if that's good or bad, but I think that it's certainly what people are rebelling against right now in both parties. I think the support that Bernie Sanders has gotten and the support that Donald Trump has gotten are the same, in the sense that these are people that want people outside the box. It's hard to argue that Bernie Sanders is outside the box.
I know. How is it that he gets that reputation? Because they do say that about him. He's not establishment. He's not mainstream. He's not, you know, but he's been around for decades.
Right. As a United States senator. I mean, I don't know how you get more in the box than that. But
because of his socialistic views, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and I think that's one thing that is really his doom, is that I like him. A lot of people like him. He's a strong statehood supporter, so we love him on that front. And I don't want to speak ill of him, but I'm not sure you can call yourself a socialist and get elected nationwide. I think that's a critical mistake that he made, because, you know, I study political science and I have a master's degree in political science. So socialism doesn't really scare me. I see it as a paradigm, a particular way of looking at things. But for most people, it's not a good word. Mm-hmm. Most Americans don't, you know, see it as a positive thing. They see it as an encroachment on their freedom and their liberty, and they equate it with, the first cousin of communism. So I think that was a critical mistake on his part, and I think that it'll ultimately lead to his undoing. But, you know, obviously people are unhappy. And I think that's going to be a problem for Trump. I mean, I think that's going to be a problem for the Republicans, because I don't see how the Republicans get out of this. Because what's really unprecedented is having a fight at the convention. I can't remember the last time they've had a fight at either convention.
A contested convention.
Yes. They turn out, they end up being more like 4 days of partying. And more like a coronation. Now, the first convention, I've been to the past 9 presidential conventions on the Democratic side. For the past 40 years, I've been in every convention. And the first one I went to, there was a minor contest, which was that Ted Kennedy attempted a move at the convention to take the nomination away from Jimmy Carter, but that was defeated on the first vote. We knew that Carter's reelection was an uphill battle, so there was sentiment inside the Democratic Party that Kennedy was a stronger candidate. At least some people believe that. So that was over almost instantly. And that's the last time that's ever happened to Democrats. And I think you have to go way, way back, way farther than that in the Republican Party to find a contested convention in the Republican Party.
Well, and unfortunately, Cruz and Rubio are suggesting that that's the solution.
Yes. And it may be the solution, given that you've got, you know, like you said, Rubio had 128 and he picked up another, 24 delegates. So he's up 150, 160. You got Cruz at 300 and you got Trump at 382. None of them may have the 1,237 that they need on the Republican side to make it. They may have to decide at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people that are encouraging that.
There are. And I'm not quite sure. It seems to me like it's almost a bar brawl at that point, you know,
yes,
where all bets are off and roll up your sleeves and start swinging. And I don't know. I mean, like, we haven't seen enough of this, the circus already, that we're going to see that on national television too.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't sound, it's not very dignified. That's for sure.
Well, and you know what? You're going to walk away in a situation like that. There's no way to bring people together, which is one of the reasons that you have the convention in the first place, right? It's like a super pep rally to get your people motivated to go into the election and work hard to get their candidate elected. There's no way, if Trump loses in a contested convention, there's no way that those Trump Republicans are going to come out there with a satisfied feeling and be able to support whoever the candidate is. I think maybe some of them will support, but a lot of them will just stay home.
I hear what you're saying, in that it's more divisive than the kumbaya that it's supposed to be. Like, you know, we're all brothers and sisters. Let's all get behind this letter that we say is ours. You know, that's one of the things that I have to say that I really was in admiration of with the Democrats during the debates early on. Even with the Benghazi things and the email and the server and like that, they did not make that really part of the discussion. They really tried to stick to the issues and the questions and, you know, not doing the mudslinging, unlike the Republicans, that it's just like I said, a bar brawl. It's, you know, who can bludgeon who quicker and better.
Right.
And it's really unseemly to me.
Well, you know, and it's so strange to hear you say that, because it's true that things have seemed to have, you know, flipped over here, because the old political maxim is that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And it seems to be going just the opposite in this election cycle, where the Democrats are falling much more in line and the Republicans are falling, you know, or at least some of them are falling in love with this kind of outside the box candidate. And I wonder how much of that has come because of their dissatisfaction with what's going on and the growth of the Tea Party inside the Republican Party. I see we have Taboo online too. Let's see what Taboo has to say. Are you there, Taboo?
Hi, yes. How are you all?
Hi, Taboo.
Good. Hi. Yeah, a couple questions. Senator Brown, I'm just wondering, when you met with Hillary, that time and she asked for your vote. Did you ask by chance as well, you get my vote if you support statehood, or does it work like that?
Well, absolutely, but I ended up supporting Barack Obama because the people of the District of Columbia had voted for Obama. So both Paul and I decided that it was appropriate for us to support Obama. But I just met with her again in Iowa. It just by happenstance, we went to, you may know, Taboo, that we went to Iowa to push for resolutions for D.C. statehood. And I got to meet with her and President Clinton at a rally just before they went on. They brought me backstage and we had a brief meeting. And that's the first question I asked both of them. And, of course, both of them said, yes, absolutely.
Did
we
they?
Support statehood. Yes. Yes.
And you said, of course, they said yes. Why do you say, of course, they said yes?
Well, because Clinton... President Clinton actually went to Capitol Hill and testified on our behalf at one point. So he's been a long-term supporter. And Secretary of State Clinton has supported – she didn't support statehood because we didn't have a statehood bill, but she supported the Voting Rights Act and other things. We, you know, were seen as similar issues, and they both said, "Yeah," and in fact, President Clinton said, "Of course, it's the right thing to do." That was his comment.
Well, why
does that make you happy, Taboo?
Well, I just, you know, I listened to the talk, but you know, I haven't really seen the walk. You know, we've had Democrat presidents, and both Congresses were controlled by Democrats, and we never got it. So I hear these, you know, so I'm just wondering who really has the influence. And matter of fact, speaking of influence, you were talking earlier about Ms. Reagan, and you mentioned the exhibit, Catholic exhibit.
Uh-huh.
My other question is, how much influence does the Pope have on our politicians and the American people? He's the head of state of the Vatican, right?
Right.
Yes.
Does he
I don't think he I don't think he has any. If I know that was the big scare with President Kennedy, was he going to be beholden to the Vatican instead of to, you know, the constituents in our country? But I personally, Taboo, I don't know what your convictions are, but I think Pope Francis is moving us forward, and I say us as Catholics, us forward like nobody else has, because of he's really liberal, you know, the Jesuit in him and everything else, and talking about discussions that have been verboten, if you will, up until this point. But I don't think Rome has any sway over the United States. Rome doesn't even have sway over American Catholics. I mean, we practice birth control, and we think that priests should get married, and we think women should be priests, and, you know, we're so liberal here in the Catholic faith that you could almost say, as my children say, Mom, you're not Catholic. And I was like, yes, I am. They're like, no, you don't agree with Rome. And I was like, well, you're right, not on a lot of things.
Well, I sometimes think there is a difference in my opinion of being political and religious. That's a belief.
Well, the founding fathers agreed with you, Taboo.
So this is what I'm saying. You know, I mean, you can religious. That's all right. But when you come and address our Congress, this is our seat of political power. That's not a church. So, you know. I mean, that to me is somewhat contradictory, or is it not?
Well,
that's a good question, but I think that you're speaking about Francis when he has visited to the United States.
If any preacher, any religious person, you have freedom of religion and free of religion. You see, religion is a form of slavery. This country was founded on the basic principle of liberty, freedom being ability to choose without the influence of someone else. Religions tell you what to think, how to think, and, you know, no offense to anybody's belief system, don't get me wrong, but just for the sake of conversation. in how we've gotten away from our guidelines. How do we determine right and wrong? This is a country of laws, values. Our values are based in liberty. That's all for liberty. And I see us too often looks like going back to a lot of the old ages that we got away from.
And well, I would say, first of all, that we've just gone from Thomas Jefferson to Karl Marx, you know, there's a lot to be said for the idea that religion is the opiate of the masses, but when it comes to politics. But the one thing you have to say about the Pope is Catholicism is still the single largest religion on the face of the planet. So his influence is that of a religious leader. I mean, it's not like he doesn't have any influence. He does. But as Maria points out, he certainly doesn't have the kind of influence in America that he does in other parts of the world. I think Congress invited him as a courtesy, like Maria said about birth control. I was raised a Catholic. I was baptized a Catholic. I've never met a Catholic woman that didn't use some sort of birth control.
Right.
So, we've defied the Catholic Church for a long time in this country.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I was asking, because I'm somewhat ignorant.
I mean, it's a good question.
It is a good question.
The people that founded this country were very religious. Thomas Jefferson, I just finished reading the Jefferson Bible, which is a collection of passages that Jefferson put together after he became president, of the life of Jesus Christ. And he was a very, very strong Christian and a great religious leader in his own right. But he also believed that religion had no place in politics, that church and state should be separate, and that you should believe in God. Your belief in God should be your belief, and you should you should keep it as secular. So let me ask you a question, Taboo. Let me ask you a question. What do you think about the stuff that's going on with people in America now being anti-Muslim? Do you think we should keep the Muslim religion out of politics too? Should we stop this nonsense of saying things like we shouldn't allow Muslims into the country?
Well, religion it's within itself. I don't care what it is. It's killed more people than anything that I know.
That's
Christianity.
True.
Christianity, what's more of a killing than Christians?
Well, you can't find one in the history of the world. It's true. The Spanish Inquisition alone killed 12 million people.
And we look right in our community today. Let's bring it real home. Look at all the killing that's going on right in our communities every day. Children killing children. Going to church every day. We've got a history of bombing churches. So this is right here at home. So, see, I like to talk about here at home that which I know, not speculation or I've read, history. This is what I know, and I see it, and I say, no disrespect to anybody's belief system, but I'd like to ask us, are we all too superstitious? I think the founders knew that. They recognized even a democracy. They knew it was the worst thing they didn't want. That's why they strictly wanted a Republican form of government. We do not operate as a Republican form of government. It's corruption right from the get-go.
There's a lot. There's a lot at the front.
The alternatives don't seem to be successful either. So I don't know if it's what is that saying about the lesser of the evils?
Yeah.
Or, we've done a pretty good job and we are human, so therefore we're subject to error. And we have been the greatest nation in the world based on that.
The founders knew that. That's why they set those three branches of government up for the balance of power.
Mm-hmm.
But you see...
Yes.
The problem is, it's not being run as it's supposed to. For example, the executive branch is supposed to enforce the laws. It doesn't do that. It makes its own laws. Congress doesn't do their job. They give their power to someone else. They put it on the other side of the seesaw. In other words, it imbalances. So that it does away with the balance of power. You all were doing an excellent job a little while ago explaining about the delegates and superdelegates. They can make a decision however they want. So they can easily be influenced, threatened, bought, everything else. So we see how the system plays. John Edwards, and I think we need to give credit to him. He was one of the first presidential candidates that I ever heard talk about the system was rigged. And I think
I'm sorry, Taboo. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, go on.
Well, I was just going to say that's right. And that was the hesitation that we all had at the Democratic Committee when they came up with the idea of superdelegates. We those rank and file people like me that was a staff person said, wow, you know, is this really democratic? That because it is a rigging of the system, right? And it is inside players making those decisions rather than letting the nominating process, the people actually do it. And you know, and my only comment about it now is that it would be a useful tool for the Republicans, but I don't think that it's a democratic way to do things. I don't believe that.
That answers the question you were asking me about what's going on, you know, with Trump and all. That's what, you know, I remember calling, you know, some shows ago when we talked about this. People see what's going on. They're tired of it. They want someone who can really hopefully get some change and make the system run the way it's supposed to. But because it's so corrupt and money is so hard, it has to take someone with money like a Trump. That's why they take Trump with all of his irregularities or differences, I should say. And we all different.
His foibles.
Yeah,
I think you're right. And if you read the Washington Post today, did you see the article on the front page of the Washington Post? There's a town in Texas, I think it's called Crystal City, Texas, and it's got a city council of 5 members and a mayor and a deputy mayor and a city manager, and everybody except for one council member is under indictment.
Oh, my gosh.
I didn't read it, but I am familiar with the case.
Yeah, there's so much corruption, they can't believe it. It's even astounded the FBI. And, you know, I mean, we're nothing if we're not honest here, Taboo. And you know that we've had the same problems in Washington. We've had councilmen resign. We've had councilmen go to jail. We've had the chairman of the city council resign. We've had several of the former mayor's campaign people plead guilty to stuff. We've had other candidates that ran for public office in D.C. Plead guilty to serious charges. And, you know, and this is in a city full of well-educated people that are supposed to be paying attention to politics. We've had this.
Well, yeah,
so there's a lot of corruption.
You know, I look right every day. I watch people go into government buildings. Now, you know, in order to go into a government building, you have to have proper ID, right?
Mm-hmm.
I watch people go in there with forged documents all the time. Okay. And you take, let's say, is illegal immigrants who come, they say they're undocumented. Well, that's an improper term, because in order to even go into buildings, you have to have documentation. They have documentation, but they're forged. That's a felony. But what we have is selective law enforcement, you know, and so it's corruption at all levels. So I say, hey, I was talking with someone the other day, and they said Metro has a saying, see something, say something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. It's difficult.
It is difficult, but Taboo, you've been really articulate and kind of relaying why people are sick of it and they don't want what has been going on as status quo. And because Trump isn't beholden to anybody, he doesn't have to worry about lobbyists and back scratching and paying back and all that stuff with the quid pro quo, that's, I believe, his probably his biggest attraction.
Yeah.
Yes, he is what we call a free man. Not, he's a free man. He's not enslaved to the money folk, you know?
Right,
and, you know,
to the system.
What, this is what, and this is what many classes of people, and particularly people with dark skin, you know, had gone through all the years. Women went through it for how many years? Poor people, you know? See, so finally enough people, and I think the key to it right now is because, you know, communication at one point used to, the fastest means of communication was the Pony Express. Now it travels, what, 186,000 miles per second, you know, speed of light. So we're set now to have a better resistance. And Bernie talking about a political revolution, I think the revolution is in Trump right now. I think that's the revolution that might be happening before our eyes.
Well, a lot of people agree with that. And, you know, the only thing that I would say, the only thing I would add to Abu is that, you know, when you talk about things like separation of church and state and the way the system was set up, Thomas Jefferson said that the most important title in a democracy is that of citizen. And when we live in the nation's capital, and in the last election, less than 50% of the registered voters came out to vote. So maybe that's the good news we take away from this, as we see more people coming to the primaries and more people registering to vote, is that, you know, part of the problem is ours because we don't pay attention and we don't go out there and we don't vote. You know, one of my favorite things is, one of my favorite issues is term limits. I say to people all the time, look, every member of Congress has either a 2-year term limit or a 6-year term limit, depending on whether they serve in the House or the Senate. If they serve in the House, they have a 2-year term limit. If you don't like them, get rid of them.
Right.
Yeah.
The problem is if you put another good person in there, it's not so much the person, it's the system. You got the whip. The whip, if you don't do what you say, you have to get in line, just like you were talking about earlier, the superdelegate. It's controlled. You can put, it's not necessarily the politician. Well, it is to a degree. Like K Street buying influence. Well, people want to demonstrate and talk about them buying influence. Well, hell, they should not be selling influence. Don't blame the buyer. It's the congressman selling influence. You know, so.
You know what, Taboo? You got no argument for me, buddy. Yeah. If you wanted to prove democracy 100% overnight, all you'd have to do is get the money out. The money is really corrupting influence. And, you know, when I worked for Jimmy Carter, I think we spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 to $75 million to run for president. In the last election, Obama spent $1 billion and McCain spent $1 billion. So, you know, the money's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And when you need that kind of money to run for president, then you're right. The system's broken because it makes you pander to people get the money that you need.
Right. So here, always wanting to put a silver lining on things, Taboo, do you see anything positive out of this discussion that we're having and what's going down this year in the political scenery with our country?
You mean today's discussion?
Yes, and the primaries. Is there any hope? Is there any good news?
Yes, there's always hope, I think. As long as we're alive, we have that ability, and that's what I think we should never lose sight of. And in a lot of ways right now, you know, it might be a lot better than it was when the country started, because you got to remember, during the revolution, the revolution really, in my opinion, has not really been told who was fighting first. You know, how many people talk about Christmas Attucks? You know, the first person to die in the American Revolution, you know. But he's not even considered a founding father, none of that. You know, James Otis Jr., we talk about taxation without representation, but we don't quote him when he said this country's for black and white, you know. So it's a lot that's been missing, but what I really want to point out is only about a third of the people really were fighting for revolution. At most, the college, by and large, didn't want separation. They wanted to be treated as citizens of Great Britain, because, you know, right after the war,
French and Indian War.
Well, see, all of a sudden now the colonists were considered, you know, the great part of the great empire. They didn't want to separate from that. But the slave people were enslaved. They were fighting to be free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what I want to point out, though, the key here is only a third of them, only a third of the people really wanted to fight. One third of them were Tories, and then you had that other third who, like a lot of people today, they just didn't want in it. They didn't care one way or the other. So I'm saying that's.
So we've always been uninvolved.
Well, you know,
the minority represents the majority.
I think
it's better now than ever, because people didn't even communicate then. So I think if you really look at it, we might be doing a lot better than we did when the country started off.
Well, you know what? One other lacking element is courage. We need courage to change things. I mean, look at what a little minister, and by little I mean short, minister from Montgomery, Alabama, did in 39 years. Dr. King was 39 when he died, and he changed the world. I mean, this is not somebody that just changed America. He changed things around the world. One person who was dedicated, and there are many levels on which I admire him, but I admire him most for his courage. And that's what it takes. It takes courage to stand up. And maybe collectively we can do that as we move at 182,000 miles a second or whatever it is. Maybe that'll give us the collective courage to stand up, because you're right.
Well, Senator Brown, could I mention a name when you mentioned Dr. King and his struggle
yes.
and courage? Do you know Fred Shuttlesworth?
No, I don't know Fred Shuttlesworth.
Fred Shuttlesworth was a guy. He invited Martin Luther King down to help them in Alabama. Fred got his head beat in some women. That was a man of courage. You're talking about courage. Fred Shuttlesworth is one of the people that come to mind when you talk about Martin Luther King. So I think, you know, it's kind of familiarize yourself with him, I think, sometime you talk about courage. And
how about people like Guyot, who we just lost here in Washington, D.C.? Another
Lawrence. Another
Guyot.
One. Thank you. In modern time, thank you. Yes, most definitely.
Yeah, I know there were lots of people like him and women who stood up and, you know, and brave, people that have been forgotten. Who do we remember? We remember Nat Turner, right? That's the guy
exactly.
that we were taught about in high school. But not people like Lawrence Guyot and Shuttlesworth and the other brave Americans that stood
so
up to oppression.
Senator
Taboo,
Brown.
I personally want to thank you for allowing the message not to be so negative. I don't want people to just throw up their hands and say the system's broken. It's never going to be fixed. We're humans, and it's beyond repair. So I appreciate that you did distill hope, because there is change possible.
Well, it's very simple. We have the laws there. This Constitution was set up, look how many others were set up after it. Now the problem is that Trump is saying when the country was great. Well, we must ask ourselves, when was it great? And I think the Supreme Court had ruled that the Constitution consists of the Declaration of Independence, the founding document, Northwest Ordinance, as well as this 1789 Constitution. And we must understand, when this 1789 Constitution left the negotiating house, it had no Bill of Rights. You see, so... let's look at the period between 1781 and 1787. You know, slavery was not, it was on its way out, you know. And I think that was a great period, because people had more morals, it appeared. You know, and someone else, George Mason, who I don't hear his name, man wrote the greatest writings of all time. We are born free.
He did.
You know, Jefferson copied the Declaration of Independence after him. And Jefferson gets all the credit. But he merely copied George Mason. And I think George Mason's name really should be, people really need to give him his credit.
Well, you know, you're right about that, Boo. And if you go to the Jefferson Memorial, as I'm sure you know, the Mason Memorial is right next to it. Just for that reason. And we've run out of time, but and we're sorry that Mr. Swoboda wasn't on, but luckily we had as our guest tonight, Taboo.
Yes, Taboo.
who made the show
appreciate all
very
of
interesting,
your wisdom.
And we thank you.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll hear from you again, Taboo. Thanks for listening, and thanks for calling in. We appreciate your input. And we'll talk to you again soon.
That was illuminating for me. I enjoyed that.
And Maria, thank you. We're gonna shut down a little bit early so that we can play a song that was written as a campaign song for Ronald Reagan, and this goes out to the Reagan family. Thanks, America. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. Have a great week.
If tomorrow all things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again. Just my children and my wife. Thank my lucky stars.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.